accession number 18802, reel 23.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 23. I was asking about the time plot for the rundown and how long it was expected to take before it was accomplished.
It sounds very silly. I absolutely can't remember the overall time scale. In detailed terms, the cap badge exercise, the manpower exercise for the army, was an annual event. And, you know, a paper was published having been through whatever performance had been through to get the balance of the cap badges for the next year correct. That was an annual thing, and that was looking 18 months ahead for an annual thing. My recollection is that we were trying to complete the rundown by 1972, I think, but I wouldn't be sure about that. And I'm talking of 68-69.
To what extent were you able to use natural wastage as a method of getting rid of people in a balanced way? Do you remember, you know, any idea of the balance between wastage on the one hand and redundancy on the other, and whether the redundancies were voluntary or you had to have compulsory redundancies?
I don't remember, because, you see, that wasn't my side of the business at all. I was responsible purely for the cap badge rundown, the slot rundown, let's call it. And when you get to the individual people who suffered as a result of all that, you're back straight over to the A side, which I'm afraid I just don't know the detail.
This committee, Committee on Organisation, SCO, how did that conduct its meetings? Was it a very formal type of procedure or an informal?
Funnily enough, I never attended a meeting because the chap from SD4A,
he
was the secretary, and he went to every meeting and he did the minutes afterwards. He came to talk to me about it, obviously. But I never actually attended a meeting. My guess is that they were informal to the extent people spoke when they felt like speaking, and certainly I've never been brought up to speak through the chairman. I've always been brought up to open my mouth when I had something to say, otherwise to keep shut up. I have a suspicion that's how these meetings were conducted. But the DASD of the day, I revert to the fact he was a very powerful individual. When I first went there, Monkey Blacker was he. And I suppose he was there for about my first year. And then it was John Gibbon, who was a very tough man indeed, and some people would describe as a brute. Actually, he was a very, very switched-on staff officer and was a very, very competent DASD. But he didn't suffer fools gladly. And I'm quite sure he would let people say their piece, provided it was relevant. Otherwise, he'd tell them to shut up.
It was a small committee, wasn't it, SCO?
Yes. Its total composition, I honestly don't remember, but, you know, it had the chairman, DASD, it had the VAG on it, the DMO on it, the VQMG on it. I think the DQMG probably attended as of right, although not necessarily every meeting. There was a financier, who I can't remember, and probably one or two other people. But that, I mean, it's quite small.
Could it co-opt if it wanted additional members?
Yes, it had power to do whatever it felt necessary to do.
Did you report direct to this man, DASD?
Yes. Well, I say yes. There was actually a DDASD deputy, and he and I, in fact, sat in next-door offices, and so I saw him daily and talked to him daily. Some things I reported to him, but technically he was my boss and he wrote my report. But in practice, an awful lot was done direct to DASD.
What were these two men, Black or Ingram, were they accessible? Could you just go along to them?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And knock on the door without...
Well, I mean, I did it through a PA, obviously. I said, you know, when's he free sort of thing. But I could go in any time I wanted.
Did they ever come down to your level, come down to your office and see you or your staff?
Not very often. I mean, I was usually summoned. But as I say, the deputy, he and I were next door. Our doors were open to talk to each other.
Yeah. Do you remember any evidence of any serious clashes?
No, absolutely not. Yeah. No, we got on very well indeed. As I say, both Monkey Blacker, who was perhaps a slightly kinder sort of officer than John Gibbon, but they both respected hard work on the one hand and competence on the other hand, and we delivered both.
Did you know that you were going to get a brigade command next after this job?
No, I didn't. Or at least not to start with, I didn't. And indeed, I would have thought at some stage it was pretty unlikely. But it so happens that the DASD also was chairman of the board that selected those sort of people. And so I suppose the fact that I'd served him well was obviously a help. And also, it so happened that when the army went into Londonderry in 1969, that it went in the shape of Headquarters 24 Brigade and a couple of battalions. And, of course, 24 Brigade was a strategic reserve brigade headquarters and really needed to be relieved as soon as possible. And I, by that time, had been appointed to command something called 8 Brigade, which was a tiny little headquarters of about 10 people in Chester. And its sole responsibility was to conduct training in places like Belize. And I can remember stumping along to DASD and saying, you know, here's this 8 Brigade, here you want to relieve 24 Brigade. Why doesn't 8 Brigade go to Londonderry and, you know, tailor-made permanent organisation to go there and relieve the strategic reserve? Now, whether anybody took any notice of that, I have no idea, but that's what happened. And in due course of time, 8 Brigade headquarters expanded its size from having been a tiny little headquarters to a more or less fully fledged field formation with a signal squadron, did some training for a short time in Chester, and then pushed off to Londonderry.
Did 8th Brigade have any battalions under its control as part of an organic brigade structure? In Chester.
My recollection is no. I think people passed through it as they were sort of attached to the brigade for training purposes.
Yes.
You know, to go to Belize or to go to wherever. Mm. And, I mean, that's what I expected to do. I didn't really expect to do anything else. But I don't think there were any permanent battalions. But, of course, by the time we were going to Northern Ireland, we'd acquired some people.
Did you have anything to do with the local territorials? Or was that outside your...
What, in Northern Ireland or in Chester?
No, when
Chester.
You were in 8th Brigade in Chester.
In Chester. I wasn't really there long enough to establish any relationships with anybody.
Mm. What about your higher headquarters, was that 5th Division?
I think yes.
So that would be Shrewsbury, wouldn't it?
Yes.
HQ, 5th Division.
Yes.
With Chester's 8th Brigade and the other brigades notional, though they might be.
I think that's correct. Mm. I'm pausing because, you know, 3DIV is always still lurking in the background.
Yes.
But I'm pretty sure what you've said is correct, 5DIV.
Mm. You mentioned that brigade appointments were made by a board. What sort of board was that? Was it part of the military secretary's empire or something aside from the military secretary?
Staffed by the military secretary's people, but yes. It was a fairly wide-ranging board. Who was all on it, I don't know. It was called the number one board, and that was it. And there are X number of selection boards for different posts. And that was number one board.
Do you know how it did its business?
No, absolutely no idea at all.
Did it? I mean, were you interviewed in any formal way for?
No. No, the whole thing, as I understand it, the whole thing is a paper business. Mm. And you're either on the list or you're not.
Yeah. Like going on the pink list?
Yeah, yeah.
Before you got the news you were going to 8th Brigade, did you have any expectations of where you might be going after you'd left ASD4?
No, absolutely not at all.
Because it is normal, isn't it, to rotate between regimental duty or command appointments and staff appointments?
Yes. A level down, certainly yes, because you're then at the commanding officer level. And that tends to be so. When you get beyond that, it becomes much more problematic because, I mean, the slots available for a command brigadier post, or indeed a colonel post, are very few and far between.
There aren't as many brigades as there are battalions.
That's right. And so, I mean, one reckon one was jolly lucky to get a slot like that.
During this time, the late 1960s, 1968 onwards, there was a considerable amount of political turbulence, some of which was taking place in Northern Ireland with the development of the civil rights movement. Did you take note of that at the time?
Very much so. I read as much as I could before I went to Northern Ireland. I tried to read impartial stuff, which is quite difficult to find. But I read about the famine, I read about some of the awful things that had happened in Ireland. I read about the civil rights, I read about Dr. Paisley, I read about John Hume, I read about everybody I could put my hands on. And so I reckon when I went over there, I went well prepared, and I reckon that I arrived in Londonderry sympathetic to the Londonderry problem, and indeed, as far as I myself as a person am concerned, my career suffered because of that. That there's no doubt about it. But, you know, we come to that a bit later.
Do you remember the Burntollet March as a specific incident?
Before my time.
Yes.
That was 1968,
yes,
if I remember correctly. And, of course, the army didn't go until 69, and I didn't arrive till early 70.
But did it alert you in any way? Do you remember?
Oh, absolutely.
At the time,
oh, yes,
it happened.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Without doubt.
I mean, do you think that other people in the MOD were similarly alerted by the Burntollet March and its implications?
I don't know is the answer to that. I suspect perhaps not enough.
When did you actually go off to Chester to take 8th Brigade? Sometime in 1969, but do you remember what month it was?
I think it was September, October, I think. September, probably.
And you found a tiny headquarters in Chester.
Yes.
Concerned with supervising training in Baileys. Was that its only function?
I'm sure it went to places other than Belize, but taking people on for training in an overseas place was its sole function. Mm. It had no responsibility for a home thing at all.
Did the headquarters itself deploy out to Baileys at all, or was it just located as a rear HQ in Chester?
I suspect the brigade commander went, probably accompanied by a BM, and everybody else stayed in Chester. I would guess, but I wouldn't be sure, because I never did it. Giles Mills was the guy I took over from, who you may or may not know, and he could tell you what went on when he had 8th Brigade, because he did Belize, he did whatever else he did. But by the time I came along, I knew I was going to Northern Ireland, and I knew that my prime job, my top priority, was to assemble the brigade headquarters plus a signal squadron, which didn't exist at all, into an entity that could conduct operations.
How long did it take you to do that?
About 2 months.
How big was the brigade headquarters when it was ready to go out and deploy into Londonderry?
I can't remember the exact size, including its signal squadron. It was probably about 100, I should think, something like that. It can't have been as many, but it's up towards that sort of...
It's just a figure including all other ranks as well as officers.
Oh, everybody, yes.
Yes, the whole thing.
Yes, absolutely. Mm. But well, you see, we having, from a staff officer point of view, from memory, when I first joined there was a brigade commander, there was a brigade major, and there was a DQMG, and that was it. And they had no backup people at all. No, I'm wrong. They each had a G3. There was a G3 ops int and a staff captain A, I think. And that was it. Well, that had to expand into an organization that was capable of running watchkeepers, running a log 24 hours a day, a radio net 24 hours a day, and so on. And so it became, well, exactly like an ordinary-sized brigade headquarters.
I was going to ask you whether it was organized on the normal and conventional basis.
Yes, absolutely.
How do you go about acquiring your signalers? Where did you get them from?
Well, they appeared from somewhere. As you know, a number of individual people appeared and made up a signal squadron. It was quite difficult for them and for me. I mean, we had to work extremely hard to get the outfit off the ground.
Do you know roughly how many men were in the signal squadron, what size it was?
I should think it was... When I said 100 in answer to your question just now, on reflection, I think that was much too big. I think the non-signal side was probably about 20, and the signal side was probably about 30 or 40, would be my recollection. But that is by no means accurate.
And presumably you also acquired subordinate units at the same time as you were forming the headquarters, putting it together. Or did you take over those on the ground?
We took over from 24 Brigade, people on the ground.
You did?
Yeah.
So you spent 2 months putting together a headquarters.
Roughly 2 months. Yes.
And this presumably, would this involve exercising it as well as...
Yes.
Yeah. What sort of exercises were you doing?
Oh, very local, very simple, radio exercises. I mean, just to sort of shake out all the wrinkles, really. Turn the outfit from a series of individuals into a cohesive whole.
What sort of operations were you simulating on the radio exercises? Were you simulating counter-revolutionary warfare or counter-insurgency or regular conventional operations?
Well, I think just ordinary signal traffic. Mm. Certainly, no special thought was given to to the pictures we were painting.
Did you have any special briefings on the political and military situation?
Very much so.
You did?
Yes.
Who gave you those?
Well, I think it was... I said that I'd done a lot of reading and so on.
Yes, but that was off your own bat.
That was off my own bat. Mm. I think probably the main briefing was from me to the staff and the signal squadron. I mean, the whole lot of us assembled together. And I think I merely said, you know, the problem is so and so and so and so, and what you've got to look out for is X, Y, and Z. Mm. I mean, it's roughly like that. But I think it was mainly from me.
And where were you getting your information from? Were you being briefed by anyone in the Ministry of Defence or
no.
Northern Ireland Office?
Certainly not Northern Ireland Office, certainly not Ministry of Defence. I suppose we must have been getting sit reps from somewhere.
Were you in contact with the headquarters of 24th Brigade once you'd...
Not on a regular daily basis, but once, of course, we went over. Yes, very much
yes.
so.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about beforehand when you were working up to take over.
Don't think so. I don't remember it.
It sounds like your own source of information were really primarily published sources like newspapers and...
Yes, and books too.
Yes,
I mean,
and books.
Yeah, history.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think I mean, we obviously read the press about, I mean, you talked about Berntollet and we talked about various other things. I mean, I remember being appalled about Berntollet and thinking, you know, this has set things back, however many generations it has set it back, etc. And I think we all went over in A Brigade conscious of the fact that that tragedy could be upon us. I mean, I think those were our feelings.
When did you actually go over?
In January 70.
And how did you get there?
I think I drove over in my own car, if I remember correctly, as being the main, most convenient way of getting it there.
What about the rest of the headquarters? Did they go by air or by sea?
I think we went by ferry and land transport.
Into Belfast?
Yes. Mm.
Did you have a lot of equipment and other gear to shift with you, or were you taking over equipment and kit in place?
We hadn't got it. I mean, we got some kit, obviously, and radios and signals gear in particular. But 24 Brigade were going to take away their own things.
Yes.
Because they were, you know, a fully fledged entity. But we took whatever was needed, but it wasn't a huge amount.
How long was the actual handover period between 24 Brigade and you?
I think from memory it was probably about a week, but I think that perhaps was mainly at my level between Peter Lang and me. It was probably rather less than a week, but he took me around to meet various people, Tony Strether, who's commanding the Gloucesters, and
yes.
John Hume and various people like that. And briefing me, really, his feelings about the political situation.
What were his feelings about the political situation?
Dodgy. With which I entirely concurred. But at that particular time, the problem in Londonderry was not a gun or a bomb. At that particular time, it was riots. And stirred in particular by Mr. Paisley. As I discovered very quickly in February.
You mentioned Tony Strether, who was commanding the Gloucesters. Mm. So you had one battalion of Gloucesters there. Who else was in the brigade area?
There was a cavalry regiment in Omagh.
Yeah.
There was an infantry battalion in Armagh.
Do you remember which one?
No, I don't. Later on, it became the Queen's Lancashires,
yeah.
QLR. I don't remember who was there at that time.
Do you remember what Tony Strether had to say when you met him? Was he...
No, I think he was an optimist. I think that's his nature. I mean, he told me, you know, what had been happening in his immediate area. But I think he was hopeful that the situation was under control. And to an extent it was.
What was his area?
City of Londonderry.
The whole city?
The whole city.
And its outskirts?
And the enclave immediately behind, yes.
And what about, do you think it was Peter Ling who was commanding the brigade?
Peter Ling, yes.
Yes, what was he optimistic about the future, or did he have a more sombre view of things?
I don't remember he expressed an opinion. I think, to be honest, he was fed up with Northern Ireland and wanted to get back to his proper 24 Brigade duties.
Do you remember meeting the local chief of police on your initial...
Very much so. Frank Lagan.
Yes.
Who... I mean, one of the things I've been brought up is that the army and police on these things must be as one. And I made my views on that quite clear from the first day. And indeed, it was quite interesting. He was all for that. And I mean, I had a permanent seat in his police station and so on. We didn't have a joint headquarters because it just didn't exist. But I spent a lot of time down there. And that police station, in fact, became the TAC headquarters for brigade headquarters when there were problems in the city. But I can remember the Inspector General, as he was then called, for the RUC, who was a Brit, whose name has gone out of my head, I'm afraid, as we speak. But he was going to do a tour of inspection of the Londonderry police stations. And he was amazed to discover me as the soldier sitting in Frank Lagan's office for his inspection. And so he said, more or less said, what are you doing here? And I said, I live here. You know, we think and work as one. And so he was quite surprised. It hadn't sort of entered his ken before.
Do you know what his background was, where he'd served before he went to?
No, I don't, I'm afraid. I absolutely forget who he was.
What about Frank Lagan? Was he RUC born and bred?
Yes. He was a... I mean, when I went there, there were things called county inspectors.
Yes.
Not divisional heads, county inspectors and county... whatever they were called. And he was a county head for the county of Londonderry, and which included the city. And he had two backup people, one called Armstrong and the other, I forget his name. And Frank was a Catholic, the other two were Protestants, and indeed one of my quite early requirements when there was a riot going on in Londonderry, and I went down to the police station and I heard the policemen singing Protestant songs, and I absolutely did my nut to Frank and said, look, you know, we can't have this, this is not what it's all about. And, you know, he saw the point. I don't think he knew it was happening, probably. But it was very difficult for him as a Catholic, I think. It was helpful to him in the local scene, with local contacts, but quite difficult in terms of his police command, I would guess.
Did you see any evidence of a difficulty, tension between him and his two Protestant subordinates?
No, I think they supported him very well. Mm-hmm.
When you first met him, what type of view did he take of prospects? Was he optimistic or pessimistic?
I'm not sure I asked him. I don't think the conversation, if I recollect, didn't go quite like that. Mm. I think we were talking about, you know, the immediate future.
Yes.
And what was it going to happen the day after tomorrow sort of thing.
Tactical level then, really.
Exactly. Mm. Because we knew Paisley was about to descend on the city. Which he duly did in February, early February. Mm. And he came religiously in February and October, knowing full well there were 3 days of riots. Mm. I mean, that's the way the scene was in those particular days. Mm. And he wasn't deterred. He said, you know, my right is to come to the city and stand in the Guildhall Square and orate from the Guildhall, which he duly claimed to do.
What were your orders as brigade commander when you went out to...
Orders to me?
To you, yes.
I absolutely don't remember. I remember having a session with Ian Freeland, who was the GSC, who I knew quite well from Camberley days, because he was my G1 there when I was a student. And I'd met him on and off since, because of my Royal Anglian connection by this time. The Land Force Command, the CLF, Commander Land Forces, I'm not sure he actually existed then, but he became Tom Acton, who was a close friend of mine, quite quickly. And I remember just discussing the scene, and I think it was just accepted. I'd do my best to control Londonderry. I mean, I don't think it was anything more specific than that, because... you know, Londonderry, after all, is where it all started.
What operations were actually going on in Londonderry when you arrived? What sort of things were being done to maintain control?
I think